Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Savage Nation, the phone number is 1-800. Well, I'm not going to read you the phone number. You all know it. It's in your speed dial. In fact, I refuse to read my phone number. I'm going to give away a free copy of my great autobiography, Psychological Nudity, to the first person listening to this show today who can tell me the name of the talk show host who stole my line, Trickle Up Poverty, today. Who stole it, and when did you hear it? Whoever gets that right wins a free copy of Psychological Nudity. And the number, of course, is 1-800-449-8255. Second item of housekeeping. Here is an email sent to Rick Davis, John McCain's campaign manager, by my producer today. Dear Mr. Rick Davis, the Savage Nation, the third largest syndicated talk show in America, has requested interviews with presidential candidate Senator John McCain numerous times in the last few months. Today we discovered that Senator McCain was booked with an unknown talk show host. Our question is this. What would you like to tell our audience of over 10 million listeners about why your candidate was booked on a show that is not even in the top 10 nationally when you avoid a show that is number three in the country? Michael Savage will be talking about this on the show today. I need a response by airtime. We did not get a response from Mr. Rick Davis. Incidentally, a footnote to this, and this should make you puke. Take a guess who Rick Davis is. Rick Davis, the chief executive officer of the John McCain presidential campaign, is a lobbyist. Who did he lobby for? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's correct. That's correct. In the year 2000, John McCain's campaign director, Richard H. Rick Davis, became the head of a group called the Home Ownership Alliance, a Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac advocacy group. Its website said that the organization was dedicated to exposing and defeating trends that would harm consumer access to the lowest cost mortgage option. There's the answer to why John McCain's campaign has been derailed. There's the answer to why John McCain is being sabotaged from the enemy within. There, in my opinion, is the reason John McCain is losing. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Who stole my phrase, trickle up poverty? When was it stolen? And what do you think of him today? Brian, San Francisco, KNEW, go ahead, you're first up.
Well, Dr. Savage, it was the golfer, and he stole it today.
Okay, now who is the golfer?
The golfer is Rush Limbaugh.
Does he have any shame? Do you think that man has any shame? He's well known as an idea thief. That's been known for his entire radio career. He takes others. Doesn't he know that you listen to many shows and you would catch him?
I guess not, and what got me was, he just said it matter-of-factly, like he just came up with it off the top of his head, you know?
Well, you know you heard it on this show first last Wednesday when I created it specifically as a gift to John McCain to use as a knockout punch against Barack Obama. And Rick Davis, the Brutus of the McCain campaign, who will not let him get on talk show hosts like this, on talk shows like this, would not give him the knockout line. Not that I think McCain is capable of using it, but I try to help him. Anyway, you win a free copy of Psychological Nudity, Brian. Thanks for being such a keen listener. Love by the Sewer Plant. Why does everybody want me to read Love by the Sewer Plant? Answer. Because sex sells. But come on, there's only one story and there's nothing dirty in it. You know what's beautiful is to write a book that sells well and not have one F word in it, not one B word in it, not one ugly word in it. Isn't it amazing that you can still make a living without being a dirtball? It's amazing to me when I watch so much television and I see the filth on these TV shows. But, hey, look, I'm not better than they are. I'm just smarter than they are. They don't understand that the people are fed up with that filth. And I've never had to use it. Never. Anyway, today's Monday. It's Blue Monday. I'm a little, you know, I am what I am. I'm sick and tired of the campaign already. I wish they would cancel it and call it off. I wish it was over already. I don't care who wins at this point. Yeah, I'm supposed to want McCain over Obama. I really can't get too involved right now. At this point, I can't get too excited over either way. We know who Obama is. We also know that McCain is, you know, not a sterling character himself. And what do you think about Colin Powell coming out like shock of all shocks for B.O.? Do you think Colin Powell came out for B.O. because of his race? Duh. You know, I thought about this. It was embarrassing for me to watch Colin Powell lie about Obama. And I thought this, and forgive me for being so blunt, but it seems to Michael Savage that the only people who don't seem to vote based on race are white people of European origin. That's an interesting observation. The only people who don't seem to vote based on race are whites of European origin. Now, why is that? If everyone else votes along racial lines, as they obviously do, and proudly, by the way, and here's Colin Powell, you know, I kind of had respect for him, not anymore, because he lied. He outright lied when he said that Obama is not a Muslim. Listen to what I'm going to read to you now. Appearing on Meet the Press Sunday, Colin Powell claimed one reason he's endorsing Obama is that fellow Republicans are spreading falsehoods about him. Specifically, Powell claimed Republicans are spreading the claim that Obama is a Muslim. Really? And he said, well, the correct answer is he's not a Muslim. He's a Christian. He's always been a Christian. Now, he's wrong about that. But listen to what Powell said.
I'm also troubled by not what Senator McCain says, but what members of the party say. And it is permitted to be said such things as, well, you know that Mr. Obama is a Muslim. Well, the correct answer is he is not a Muslim. He's a Christian. He's always been a Christian.
Okay, stop right there. Either Colin Powell is ignorant or he's lying. Because by Obama's own admission, he was not always a Christian. In his own book, he says he became a Christian in his late 20s after meeting the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Jr. You should be known that Obama was raised partially as a Muslim during his childhood. Everybody knows that. Barack Hussein Obama, better known as B.O., was born to a Muslim father by the same name from Kenya. And after his father ditched his mother and him, the mother being a secular humanist, by the way, the mother remarried, this time to another Muslim man, but this one from Indonesia. And then the couple moved from Hawaii to Indonesia. And while Obama was there, he attended two schools and was registered as both in Indonesia as a Muslim student. He studied the Quran. He prayed with Muslim students. And according to family members, he attended mosque with his father. This was detailed by the Los Angeles Times and republished by the Baltimore Sun in an article called Islam, an Unknown Factor in Obama Bid. Now, if anyone wants to call the LA Times and the Baltimore Sun right-wing rags, go ahead and do so. The fact of the matter is Obama is lying, and now Colin Powell is lying. However, having said that, I have said repeatedly on this show, why should he hide his Muslim past? There are many loyal, patriotic people of the Islamic faith in America. And I have said before, a person of any faith should be able to become president in this country. I've said that. But I've also said that the media ripped Mitt Romney's Mormon faith. They made Romney's Mormon faith an issue in the GOP primaries. They've also ridiculed Sarah Palin's faith. And yet we're not allowed to talk about Obama's faith. And that's why I say Powell's a liar or he's wrong about Obama's Muslim past. And as a footnote, the only people who don't seem to vote based on race are white people of European origin. That's all. This is the Savage Nation. So let's see what we've covered so far in the opening segment of the Savage Nation. One, we found out that Rush Limbaugh stole my phrase, trickle-up economics. And I want you to go to michaelsavage.com. I'm not taking this. I refuse to take it. Go to michaelsavage.com, and you'll see that we posted it last Wednesday – on this show when I said, here's a line for McCain to win the debate tonight with. And McCain did not use the knockout punch line. And we know why. And that is because his campaign manager, Rick Davis, who refuses to permit McCain to go on this show, was once a lobbyist for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, since Fannie and Freddie were run largely by Democrats, ipso facto, I can guarantee you that Rick Davis will have a fat old job when he shafts McCain and goes to work for Democrat after the election. I'll be back.
Savage.
All right, so that's as the world turns. You know what I mean? That's it. It's Blue Monday. We know that the golfer stole my line. And you know, if he's a big enough man, he gets credit. That's all. But he didn't. And I'm going to make a point of it. And number two, Colin Powell is either wrong or a liar about Obama's Muslim past. It's a fact of reality. And I lost all respect for both parties, incidentally. Sacramento, Tony, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
It's an honor, Dr. Savage. I completely, the golfer is part of my morning routine, such as the Savage Nation is my afternoon routine, and I completely was floored this morning when I heard that, and I'm like, and I was waiting. He had so many opportunities after he said, I was waiting for him just to acknowledge where he got it from or just say on a previous show or something, but then he let the subject close and no mention, no nothing, and I lost all respect for that.
Well, I think people diminish themselves by using others' ideas without giving credit, and I think that they make themselves bigger by giving credit. How hard is it? I don't understand that part of it. Anyway, thanks for the call. Here's a restaurant horror story from Saturday night because I got a beauty for you. I don't know how to put it other than I went to my favorite Chinese restaurant, not the one with the, you know, lipstick on a pig, that thing with the Sarah Palin? Well, this is crazy glue on a lip, this Chinese restaurant, which I didn't go to because the one with crazy glue on a lip, I couldn't go near. No matter what I said to her after 20 years, it was still like eating crazy glue. So I stopped going there. So I go to another one, and it's really very good. Now, this is not a restaurant horror story. This is a liberal customer horror story. Quiet Saturday night, not busy. Food is better than ever. Nice people. Loud table with a screaming infant of 10. Now, all right, it's Chinese. You figure that's life. This type of restaurant is known to attract families, so you figure if you don't like family, stay at home and eat. What do you expect? I raised children, so you put up with a crying child. But this was not just a crying child. This was a screeching liberal infant with a, I don't know how to describe the mother other than untasteful looking. I don't know how to describe the father other than wimpy lib, long-haired wimpy lib father. I don't know how to describe their friends and relatives other than distasteful looking. Everyone at the table looked bad, and the baby was screaming. I didn't say anything, but I got to, you know, blah, 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 blah. Went on forever, and I said, you know, when I raised children, I said to Mrs. S., I said, if our kids did that, didn't I take the child out of the restaurant? Didn't I walk with them out of the restaurant and say to them, you can't do it? Yes, we always did. Okay, fine. I want to make sure I wasn't inventing it in my head, but they didn't do that. Now the check comes. Now there's a long discussion about the check, as all liberals, you well know. They're very, very liberal with your money. But when it comes to their money, they're the cheapest SOBs I've ever seen in my life. There's a fake poet here in San Francisco named Lawrence Spaghetti. I remember this bum. Oh, he's as liberal as they come. Mr. Progressive, down with the system, down with Bush, you know. Meanwhile, the bookstore he owned, I was well known, was held by, as far as I know, a holding company in Paris all the years he was talking about the system and ripping people off. But that's his. Now, when I would go out with those guys in North Beach years ago, you should see him run after a restaurant bill came. They would divide it up to the penny and leave no tip. The bigger the liberal, the bigger the progressive in those days, the less the tip. They would cut it up to the penny and usually leave 26 cents for a tip. Okay, so now, here's the same thing in this restaurant. They're arguing over the bill, down to the dime, give me 12 different varieties, blah, blah, blah. Again, I said, okay, I don't care. In other words, cheap university types. Now, after they divided up the tip and the bill, they congregate. They get up and they congregate waiting to leave to talk more, guess where? Next to my table. And they're leaning back into my table, talking loud with their butt against the table. Now, what are you going to do in a situation like this? When people have no manners, they're wearing Obama buttons. You're going to argue with people like this? You just look at them and you know what low-life people they are. They're not even narcissistic. They're ignorant people. This is liberalism at its worst. And by the way, not all liberals are this way. There was another table of university types, probably a little wealthier, probably tenured. They were quiet, drinking a bottle of wine, five, six people. I didn't care if they voted for Obama, but they didn't wear the button all over the place and make you listen to them, if you know what I'm talking about. And that's another report from Ground Zero of what America will soon be experiencing in Nancy Pelosi's America, who I affectionately call Nancy Mussolini, because she wants to introduce Mussolini-like tactics in the United States media. So my biggest statement is about Powell, which is that the only people who don't seem to vote based on race are white people of European origin. And, you know, that becomes a philosophical question worth talking about. Why are white people of European origin the only people who don't seem to vote based on race? Is it because they're more tolerant? Is it because whites of European origin are more accepting and more tolerant of other races? I wonder if they're going to be that way once they find out that not all people love them as much as they may think. You know, I don't want to talk about four topics today. No Joe the plumber, no Obama, no Ayers. Can we get all those calls off the line? I can't take any of those. I am so tired of all of this. Please don't say Joe the plumber to me. I don't know who he is. I don't care. Eddie the electrician, yes. You want to talk about Eddie the electrician? Sure. Or how about Obama's good friends Hamas and Gaza? Where in Gaza, Hamas's leader Ismail Haniyeh calls the global credit crisis a punishment from God. Wow. Look who's talking. Look who's talking. A punishment from God. What kind of people build an entire life around killing in order to go to heaven and get 72 virgins? All right, so Colin Powell is either wrong or a liar about Obama's Muslim past. I mean, it was reported in the LA Times. By his own admission, he was not always a Christian. And why Powell has to destroy his own reputation to support Obama is sad in a way. I mean, Powell has always been a moderate all his life, and it's his right to be a moderate. But that doesn't mean he has to suddenly go into the camp of the liars. You know, one of the Ten Commandments is, neither shalt thou bear false witness against thy neighbor. Well, by lying about your neighbor, that's bearing false witness against thy neighbor in its own way. It's an interesting way of looking at things. Neither shalt thou covet thy neighbor's wife, nor shalt thou desire thy neighbor's house, his field, or his manservant, or his maidservant, his ox, or his ass, or anything that is thy neighbor's. I don't know, they're pretty straightforward rules, you know. We know the others, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, neither shalt thou steal. And those are pretty clear, but thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. That's a pretty big one. Coveting, that's a hard one. But the bear false witness is an interesting one. Lying about people like that, that's an interesting one. You know, all religions are pretty clear on that. Anyway, I'm not even in a religious mood, to be honest with you. I'm kind of burned out from the whole election. It's gone on for, it seems forever, the endless election. You know, bread and circuses. I would rather read, I don't know, I'd rather read a novel. Well, I saw a great movie last night on TV. I had meant to watch this movie when it came out in the theaters about 6 months ago. Sidney Lumet was the director at 83. Great movie, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Unbelievable. With Albert Finney, did anyone see it? Raise your hand if you saw Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. No one. Okay, I'm the only one who watches movies. I meet more people lately. They don't watch movies even on TV. No, I don't have a TV in my house. Now my children are going to grow up without a television. I don't know how to answer them. How can you raise a child today without a television? Now, it's true. I did that when the kids were young. I admit it. But that was a different age. And I did once throw a television down a flight of stairs when I came home. I was exhausted from work, and they were glued to the TV. I walked through the front door, and I said hello, and they didn't say anything to me. So I didn't scream and yell. I did pick up the television, I will admit it, pulled it out of the plug. Children looked at the TV as it went down the cement steps on the outside of the house, sparkling all the way. I said, now let me say again, hello, children. Hi, Dad. How are you? I mean, I understand the power of this black box. I understand it's a black hole and can destroy a child's mind, but you raise a child who's 14 who's never seen television? That doesn't make sense to me. You know, when you send them to a religious school, and what are they going to do when they hit the real world? I can't imagine. I just can't imagine what they're going to do when they hit the real world. Let's see what else went on in the world over the weekend. Anything exciting other than crazy glue on the lips in the Chinese restaurant, libs in the aisle? Nothing. It's very unexciting stuff, you know. Medford, Oregon. Jenny, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, what a pleasure it is to speak to you. I love you.
Thank you. I don't blame you.
Who's going to play you in the movie about your life? And I have a suggestion, if you don't already know.
Well, wait a minute. Oh, let's back up. First of all, I put that on the back burner when I was writing Psychological Nudity. I had to finish that. Then I had the lawsuit I was dealing with, which I still am dealing with. I'm trying to create a third party, which is harder than I thought. The two parties have set it up so that it's almost impossible to create a new party. I do want to do the Michael Savage story in 09, but it's going to be a documentary, Jenny, not a dramatization. You understand?
Oh, I see. Okay.
So who would you play me if it was not a documentary?
Well, I personally think Bruce Willis is a great candidate. He's an action hero, but he can do comedy. He can do serious drama. He can do it all, and he's...
All right, but I'm not doing... Yeah, he's not a bad actor. I lost all respect for him a year ago when he brought his daughter to a vile, almost pornographic movie he was in, saying he was proud to bring his daughter to it. I thought it was sickening to read it. So I have no respect for almost any movie star, honestly. I think they have polluted the mind of the world more than any other factor on earth. I think Hollywood sewer pipe is responsible for more of the moral meltdown than any other factor in the history of the world. You agree with me?
Yes, I do.
And here's a man who loves movies. But again, I want to reiterate, you don't have to produce filth in order to get people to watch a movie. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. I feel a migraine coming on already. It's early in the week and already a migraine on early Monday. My God, what is it? Oh, God, every time you open up another website, Palin did this and Palin did that and McCain said this and McCain is angry and Obama's the saint and he's got the halo. Don't these people understand that nobody wants to read this anymore? Let me see what's on my website by comparison, because I haven't even looked at it today. I mean, I sent a few stories to the webmaster. Let's see what my lead is. I want to until it downloads. You can faint here. Obama relies on black pride for record turnouts. Great. That's great. Obama can count on winning up to 95% of black voters. How come McCain can't count on winning up to 95% of white voters? Anyone have an answer to that one? Here's another one. Rules eased for food stamps. Did you see that little story today from USA Today? You see how many people now are on the grift? Wait, where's that article here? I got it right here. Look at this. Black pride, 95%. Rules eased for food stamps. But did you know they don't even call it food stamps anymore? Like if I go to a supermarket, I see a person in front of me buying, I mean, looks like luxury items with food stamps. I really get upset. They don't call it food stamps anymore. The government in 08, in the 08 Farm Bill, changed the name of the food stamp program to SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Spokesmouth for the USDA, Gene Daniels, said this is a nutrition program, not a welfare program. Half the 29 million Americans who receive aid are children. SNAP serves one of every five of the nation's kids who are also eligible for free or reduced price school meals. Now, I have a question. How many people on food stamps are not citizens? Why don't you ask Obama that, and why don't you ask McCain that? So there it is. It says some states are going further to expand eligibility. Last month, California enacted a bill that will allow low-income people to keep some savings and still qualify for food aid. At least four other states, Maryland, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Vermont, similarly eased the asset test this year. States are allowed to adjust eligibility rules, and more are doing so. As of October 1, Washington State allowed people with slightly higher incomes up to $42,000 for a family member to qualify. New York, so they don't call them food stamps anymore. They're called SNAP. It's called a nutrition bill, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. This is not your father's food stamp program, says Heidi Tringe, policy advisor to Vermont's Republican Governor Jim Douglas. Recipients no longer get vouchers. They get debit cards. You hear this? Debit cards. Another benefit of the socialist government we are already living in. 1-800-449-8255. Hey, could you play some of that pirate music for me? Play me Billy Bones from Skip Henderson. I want to sing along for a minute. Because I'm... You got... Bones, Billy Bones, Bones, Bones.
Davy Joe's of rum and gold and wench's bone. You had your last fill, Billy Bones.
The lyrics are amazing. They're Sea Ditties, played by a local group out here in Alameda.
Good morning to
I
you,
love it.
Billy.
It's all the work. Hold it. You know, I played this in the house, and a friend came over, and she said the music. What's the word? Morbid. She said it's a very morbid lyrics. I said yes. I've always been a morbid personality, and you know, I hadn't heard the word morbid in about 30 years. Do you know why? Do you know that if you're morbid, you're not permitted to exist in America? You got to be happy. If you're not happy, you're sick. You need medication or therapy if you're morbid. I realize I've been morbid since I'm 6 years old, once I understood what the world was. I've been a very morbid person. So what? Is it a crime to be morbid? Where is it written I cannot be morbid or I can't have a morbid view of the world? In fact, it makes me happy. The more morbid I get, the happier I get. Isn't that a strange phenomenon? Why is that? Is anyone else out there a morbid type of personality? Now, what does that actually mean, morbid? Think about it. I mean, you look at the origin of the word morbid. I don't have my thesaurus here. Beowulf, what is morbid derived from? I have to run across the studio to get the book. But morbid, moribund, mort, obviously dead, death, mort, from morgue, from... All right, so it's related to death-like things, obsessed with death. Hey, my friends, if you're religious, you're morbid, because all of religion is built upon morbidity. Did you know that? Ha, 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 ha. You didn't know that. If you're a very religious person, you're a morbid person. Every prayer is about dying, death, not dying, or not, and when you do die, to not be punished. So what does that make you if you're religious? Morbid, yes. But think about what I'm saying to you. How long has it been since you've heard the word morbid? I haven't heard it at all, like for 30 years. No one uses it. It's almost like an illegal state of mind to be morbid. Why? Why is it? Because of medication, psychiatry? The psychiatrists say you can't be morbid, you must be depressed. There's a huge differential between depression and morbidity. You know what I'm saying? Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Do you have any idea what I'm saying to you? That if you say depressed, you're throwing into that category a whole slew of emotions that may not be depression. There's such a thing as sadness. I know a man who just buried his dog. Is he depressed? No, he's sad. Do you understand that? No. The guy said to me, he's a good friend of mine, very nice man. He said that he had to put his dog to sleep in his arms, like over the weekend. He held his dog that he owned for 14 years. The dog had been sick for months. Finally, it was too much. And the vet, you know, terminated the dog's existence in his arms. I said, oh, my God. And he said to me, you know, I buried a mother, a father, and a brother. And he said, this was the hardest of all. I said, oh, my God. And then we actually talked for a minute about why seeing a pet die is so painful to people. I said, well, it's probably because they're innocent. And he said, yes, and they can't express themselves. They can't express their pain. And you know they're suffering, and you look at them, and you don't know what to do. I said, well, it's also because they give you more pleasure than your family does. Now, does that make me cynical to say a thing like that? You know, so you talk about morbid. What's wrong with being morbid? I'm morbid. I've always been morbid. Now play the other song, not that one. There's another pirate song that I like.
15 men on a dead man's chest. Yo-ho-ho,
ho, ho, and a bottle of rum.
Drink and the devil have done for the rest.
Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum.
Rum, 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 of rum, rum, rum. Bottle of rum.
The mate was fixed by the bosun's pipe.
I love this. Okay, you don't know the lyrics. I'm printing up song sheets to this. I'm printing up song sheets. All right. I have a free boat ride I'm doing for a few friends on election eve. It's closed to the public. And one of the things, I have a lot of things planned. One of them is song sheets to these songs. I'm going to play sailor music. You think about being a seaman, you know, S-E-A-M-A-N, seaman. And what a life that was. A whaler, whatever. One of the roughest, toughest lives ever on the planet Earth was being a seaman, particularly in those ages of sail. And they died. They died horrible deaths. And when you think about a sea captain in those days, he had to be not only a superb navigator and a superb seaman, but he had to be tougher and meaner than any sailor on that on the crew. He had to be able to beat up any sailor in the crew, most likely, or he wouldn't have remained captain on most of these ships because they wouldn't respect you unless. So think about it. Take the toughest Hell's Angel you've ever seen or visualized in a movie. Now take that personality and add seamanship, leadership, navigation skills, and you have a sea captain of the sailing era. Can you understand what I'm saying to you? How we've fallen from that era to the age of the U.S. Navy today, where they have MBAs from Yale as captains, who are more interested, it seems to me, in diversity training than they are in defeating the pirates off the coast of Somalia. I'll be right back.
Savage.
15 men on a dead man's chest. Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum. Drink and the devil had done for the rest.
For the rest.
Yo ho
yo, ho,
ho
and a bottle of rum.
Bottle of rum.
Bottle of rum.
The mate was fixed by the bosun's pipe.
Bosun brain with a marlin spike.
Cookie's throat was marked like.
It had been gripped by fingers ten.
There they lay, all good dead men. Like break a day in a boozing.
It is the Savage Nation.
Full
of rum, rum, rum.
Full
of rum. Okay, even in those days, they gave the men a drink now and again for the horrible, grueling boredom at sea. The U.S. Navy doesn't even let them have a beer on a ship. I was amazed at this. Why would it hurt them to have one bottle of beer a day? How would that hurt them? I once remember I went aboard a, I think, oh, God, it was 20 years ago. I think the French Navy, the Italian Navy, they drink. You might say, well, great. They were very effective. They were really effective in World War II. All right, you could argue that. I mean, you could make that argument. But, I mean, I think they serve wine on French and Italian ships. Who knows what they do? Our ships don't do very much. All they do is steam around and belch out a lot of smoke. They can't even smoke these pirates off Somalia. They have to refer to some schmuck back in Tallahassee at Central Command to see if they can fire a 22 caliber warning shot at the pirates. What's the point of this $1 trillion Navy if it can't do anything? The whole country's like this behemoth that can't do anything. From Wall Street, forget about it. Is it any wonder that I, you know, eat too much, drink too much, mild brioche? That's... Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, director Sidney Lumet, writer Kelly. Did anyone see this movie? Is anyone morbid out there? Utah, Brian, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, how you doing, sir?
Good.
I'm a morbid optimist, just like yourself.
A morbid optimist. I love it. That's so well put.
The way I got morbid was because my grandmother always used to say, now she was from England, and my grandfather met her during World War II. He stormed the beaches of Normandy. Actually, Omaha Beach, and he met her and brought her back to New Jersey. And she always used to tell me, "Oh, you're gonna burn in hell, matey. You're gonna burn in hell." And it, she says, "You're so morbid. You're so morbid." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And she would just, make me feel like I was just the most depressed, sadistic person in life. But I'm not. I care about this country. I love this country.
Right. There's no reason you can't be morbid. I mean, where is it a crime to be morbid?
what I'm saying. It's like everybody said, if you care about this country, if you love your country and you want to see it the best for this country, you're considered morbid nowadays. And it's totally ridiculous. Everything.
But if you look at Obama and you have a terrifying feeling that this unqualified fake candidate could wind up running the United States of America, that's enough to make you more than morbid.
Exactly, my friend. That is enough to make you sick. Both of these candidates, I tell you, I will not vote for either one, and I am a staunch conservative. My hero.
How do you feel about John McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, who we learned today used to lobby for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, will not let McCain come on this show? What does that tell you? I think Rick Davis is afraid of being exposed more than he's afraid of McCain answering questions to Michael Savage. I think he's afraid I'll ask McCain, why would you hire a campaign manager who worked for Fannie and Freddie? I think he's protecting himself.
I'll tell you what, anybody who will go on Saturday Night Live and whore them or prostitute themselves out, excuse my language, prostitute themselves out to these left-wing leftists and just ignore the right-wing, they'll never come
and
on.
And David Letterman, that talentless goofball? A guy who couldn't do his own show while his writers were on strike?
Exactly.
McCain will go there and apologize to him. And let me tell you something. 90% of the people or more who watch Letterman, if they voted all, are going to vote for Obama. While my audience is the prime gold that all the candidates want, and they won't come before you. Why is that, Brian?
Michael, on a serious note now, I have been a patriotic American my whole life. I'm a small business owner. I have worked my butt off. I'm not very educated like yourself, sir, but I have worked my tail off to succeed in this country. And I am tired of the sheep following Obama and McCain. And, ooh, if you don't vote for Obama, then you're gonna, or if you don't vote for McCain, then Obama's going to get in, and then bad things are going to happen. Oh, if you don't vote for McCain, or if you don't vote for, you know what
right.
I'm saying.
It's all fear. The whole thing's built on fear. Neither of them will touch the most important topics of our time. In the last debate last Wednesday, they didn't even talk about the meltdown on Wall Street or what to do about Henry Paulson, the dictator of America. The Treasury Secretary has become a de facto dictator of this country. And I'm going to disclose in the next hour what he did over the weekend to give a sweetheart deal to Wells Fargo. You're not going to believe it.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I'm also troubled by not what Senator McCain says, but what members of the party say. And it is permitted to be said such things as, well, you know that Mr. Obama is a Muslim. Well, the correct answer is he is not a Muslim. He's a Christian. He's always been a Christian.
It is the Savage Nation exposing one lying politician at a time. Welcome back to the program. Welcome to the program. So Colin Powell is either an ignoramus or a liar, because the L.A. Times has clearly shown, and Obama by his own writings has stated, that he went to Muslim schools as a child in Indonesia. So why hide it? Not every Muslim is a terrorist. Be clear about that. You know, I don't give people a religious litmus test when they run for office. I wish that it wasn't an issue, but it is. When you start lying about it, I mean, it's another story. Topic number two is whatever you want to make it. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. In this hour, we have a really, really, really big hour for you on the Savage Nation. At the turn of the hour, we're going to have a very famous screenwriter named Joe Esterhaus on the show. Joe Esterhaus wrote Showgirls. He wrote Basic Instinct. And there's a long, interesting story. He's written a new book about his newly found Christian faith. And it's an amazing tale in a way, because when you give up the Hollywood lifestyle and you move back to where you grew up in a suburb of Cleveland with your wife and four sons, and then you find out that you have throat cancer, and then they remove 80% of your larynx, and then you quit drinking and smoking when you've been doing such since you're 14, and you say that you were born again or you've seen God and it's changed you so much. I think it's an interesting interview. I read his book, and I'm going to have him on the show today. That's all. It's an interesting topic. Normally, I don't do this kind of interview. You say, who the heck wants a guy like this, you know? Who wants a guy who says he went from showgirls to God or from Basic Instinct to Paul? Who's going to believe him? That's your first instinct. Ah, come on. But, you know, if you read it and you give a man, you know, you give a man your own faith, you're going to find that there may be faith in the man. How's that? Does that work for you? You can be cynical up to a point. So he'll be on the show. Now let's go to the callers on the Savage Nation. The phone number is, by the way, you don't have to be morbid to call the Savage. It helps. It's helpful if you're morbid. Did anybody see Before the Devil Knows You're Dead by Sidney Lumet, directed? I can't believe the billing in this movie, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. They bill Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's excellent, by the way. Ethan Hawke, excellent. And like as an afterthought, they mentioned Albert Finney. Albert Finney stole the show. I mean, the man is such a big actor that every scene he's in, he literally, the entire movie revolves around Albert Finney, the father. How could they not even mention him? Billy Bones, San Francisco, Eugene, KNEW, welcome, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yes, Michael, I've seen the Skip Henderson at Quinn's Lighthouse on the Sea Shanty Nights on Thursday.
Yeah, let me explain this to the audience. There's a local group called Skip Henderson. He does the seafaring music that I love. And I got it in a new little boat I bought, and I can't stop listening to it. How is it live? Is it good?
Oh, yeah, excellent. Skip is pretty animated, too. You know, some of the other guys kind of sit there, and they play their instruments pretty well. And he's a sailor. He was gone for a while, I think with a schooner into the Pacific. Then he came back. So, he's very animated. He's a really interesting guy. The Dead Man's Chest is actually a rock formation in the British Virgin Islands. I've been down there with Captain Nick Castruccio. And it looks like it's not really an island. It's kind of like a key, and it sticks out of the water. It looks like the edge of a chest. And
because the song starts like this, 15 men on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum. I guess he means 15 men on dead man's chest, not a dead man's chest.
They would strand people there, like if somebody was, like, out of control. This is what I heard.
Oh, you know, they put him on, like, a little devil's island. Eugene, let me ask you, for people who don't come from the Bay Area, this great group, this local group that has no national prominence, I hope they do, I've never heard them live. Do they ever appear anywhere else in the Bay Area?
You know, at the Hyde Street Pier on the Bacluth, they do have that 4 or 5 days of sea shanties. I think it's in the fall, and I'm pretty sure. Starboard.
I thought they were true Irish or English seafaring songs, truthfully. I didn't know where they came from.
Yeah, well, they're sea shanties, which are working songs, Mike. You know, that's why they're short on the stanza, and it's for hauling the lines on raising and lowering sails.
Yes, I see, to get the people in the cadence of pulling.
Right, exactly. You know, Francis Drake had that famous quote about the gentleman will hail and pull with the sailors and the sailors with the gentleman. So the hail and pull is to respond to, you know, and then pull on the line.
So in other words, when this song is playing, you can literally feel men pulling together on a line to pull up a sheet.
Right. Well, yeah, right. On the halyard to raise the sail, or and a windlass, you know, when they bring the anchor up, the big windlass.
Oh, yeah. I'm lucky I have an electric windlass.
I would say it's a modern age, you know.
I step on a button on the floor of the deck and the chain comes up. Believe me, I don't want to pull 120 feet of chain up out of a mud bottom.
Oh, I hear you. That was one of my little things with Captain Nick. I wasn't fast enough on the anchor, and he'd kind of tell me to keep moving.
Well, you can get your hand ripped right off on an electric winch. I mean, you got to be so careful. You get anywhere near it, you can lose a hand. Hey, thanks, Eugene. Thanks for that. We're talking about a number of different things: loss of pets, being morbid, a movie, a stolen phrase called trickle-up economics, stolen, unfortunately, by your hero, rush the golfer Limbaugh without any credit, which is sad. I mean, you'd think more of a guy like that, you know. Books are shipping. Only a few thousand copies left. Order now to insure against missing for the holidays. Look, I'm not lying to you. We're way past the halfway point of the first printing, and they're going like crazy since I announced that they got them on the... Remember, we had a show on Thursday, Friday. People were reading from the book. If you just got a copy of Psychological Nudity and you care to call the show and tell me what you think about it, as long as you loved it, you'll get right... You'll get right on the show. New York City, WOR. We're talking about another topic now. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. You know, your friend's comment about losing a pet really hit a nerve with me. I'll try to get not to get too morbid or maudlin here. But,
yeah.
You know, I think what it is about pets is that they're so much a part of your daily routine. Even family members can be somewhat distant. You know, maybe you see them on holidays.
I think you're right. I absolutely agree. Like, I get up, Teddy gets up. I lie down, he jumps in bed. I go to the bathroom, he wants to sit in the bathroom. I take a shower, he's outside the shower. I mean, this guy just wants to be my friend. I don't know what I'm going to do when he, you know, when he got to cross over. I don't know what I'm going to do. I've lost dogs before. I'm too attached to this one.
No, I know exactly what you mean. And when they're gone, you really notice them not being there. Everything you do, you notice it constantly. That's why it's very hard.
I can't take it. I can't take another one. I got a box upstairs with Snowy's ashes in it. It's so crazy to me, the whole thing. How could something that was here be gone and there's nothing left? You know, the whole concept of life is bewildering to me, to tell you the truth, because it brings back your own mortality. Here I am in front of a microphone, and I'm gesticulating, I'm talking, I'm thinking, I'm using my brain, I'm using all my faculties. I can't conceptualize of not being here. Do you know that, Steve?
No, absolutely. I know what you mean. And it's, you know, when it comes to pets, you know, they're also very dependent on you, too. So then when they get sick, you wonder, gee, could I did something differently? Maybe it's a little bit my fault. You know, it's, that's another part.
It's not your fault. As long as you didn't feed them any food from China, it's not your fault. Well, I'm not kidding you. There's an article on my website that we just put up. I just found it about an hour or half an hour ago. The pet food from China. I don't know where the article is. It's about, oh, here it is. 1,500 Chinese dogs die from tainted feed. Some 1,500 dogs bred for their raccoon-like fur have died after eating feed tainted with melamine. Now, first of all, the idea of raising a dog for fur is number one. That's number one of the nice, sensitive people from China. The wonderful people who torture bears, the wonderful people who raise dogs like St. Bernards in a cage from puppyhood to kill them for food. Wonderful. We're supposed to believe it's a civilized society. Now we find out they're producing such contaminated food that the animals are dying from the food itself, you know. I'm very serious. You got to be very careful where this dog food comes from that we're using.
Absolutely.
Thanks for the call. That's all. 1-800-449-8255. Did anyone see Before the Devil Knows You're Dead by Sidney Lumet? I've asked it already. Oh, here's the call. Jim in Tampa, Florida. Welcome to the program.
I saw that movie, and it was... It was compelling. It was that director had the ability to put you in those guys' place, and I don't think I can watch it again. It was very disturbing.
How about Albert Finney as the father? Didn't he steal the show?
Oh, yeah, that was a fantastic movie. I mean, it was fantastic. At the same time, I kind of classify it as horror, along with, like,
Wrecking. Yeah, it's a family horror show, you know, when it turns out. Look, I can give a basic plot. It's two sons. They set up to rob their parents' jewelry store. In a kind of a victimless crime, they're going to use a toy gun because they're broke. One of them is a gambler or a drug user. And they're just going to hold up the store with a toy gun wearing masks, right? And everything goes wrong. And they wind up killing their mother.
And it just goes down the toilet. And you put yourself...
One thing leads to another, but it's so well done, it's shocking.
It is shocking. It's like Requiem for a Dream. I don't know if you've ever seen that one. That one.
No. And let me ask you something. I only got the last half of the movie last night on Showtime or wherever it was. Philip Seymour Hoffman plays... the brother Andy, right? Now, when he goes to the drug dealer, do they imply he was having a gay thing with the drug dealer too, or he was just there for the drugs?
I don't recall that part. I was consuming barley distillates at the time, so I don't recall all the...
Well, because remember when he goes there the next time, and I don't want to give away the plot, and he knocks off the guy in bed? Was that a drug thing or a gay thing?
Oh, I don't know. It might have been.
Well, the drug dealer was clearly like, you know, a gay guy, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And I thought that was amazing that they would even dare show a gay in such a negative light. Is that permitted in Hollywood?
Well, I never had heard of that movie, and someone...
No, it's shocking that they could show a gay person in a negative light. I don't know how they got it produced. Thanks for the call. Phone number 1-800-449-8255. This is breaking news in the Savage Nation. I'll be right back. Savage. Definitely, definitely the Savage Nation. And we're definitely not talking about Obama and McCain, which I think is a miracle. We only mentioned them a little bit. We said that Colin Powell is either an ignoramus or a liar about Obama's Muslim past. He really should do his homework because even Obama has said that he was raised as a Muslim during his childhood. The facts are indisputable. And, you know, we covered it. That's all. Now we're covering other things, movies, books. Death of pets. And in a few minutes, we're going to have the screenwriter Joe Esterhaus on with his new book, because it's an interesting book in that here's a guy who wrote Showgirls, Basic Instinct. Who hasn't seen Basic Instinct? And to go from Showgirls or Basic Instinct to God and write a book about it takes a lot of you know what, because who's going to believe you? But if you read a little bit, you realize that the guy's laying it on a line the way he sees it. You know, he found God, and God's helped him. So I think that's a great topic coming from a guy who was basically a cynic and didn't believe in any of that stuff. What seems to be more interesting, I don't want to give the interview away why I want to have him on. I'll do it during the thing. So what would you like to talk about? San Diego, Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation topic. Please go ahead.
I got your book today, and, you know, you just hit my heart hard on chapter one. I said, thinking of my grandfather, and I firmly believe by the age of 10, I learned everything I needed to know for the rest of my life from a man who was born in the late 1800s.
Now, and, wait, hold on. This is a very interesting statement. How does that relate to my book, Psychological Nudity, though?
It relates to it in chapter one specifically, and I really don't want to go fast through this book because it is so well written. My grandfather was one to fix things and take his time in understanding how things work.
Okay. Okay. I get it. I get it. Fix things. Yeah. I understand that. Everything takes a lot of time to do it right.
Yes, sir, and that's the way he was. He was a machinist, and he liked to tinker with things in the basement and explain the way things work. And if they didn't work, well, he was going to find out why at least.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I hope you enjoy my book. I want to read the introduction. It's one page, please. Not the whole thing. Let me cut out some of the... The stories in this volume were selected because they stand out from my years of telling what happened in my everyday life. Did I leave anything out? Sure. Could I write another 10 volumes? See Lawrence Stern's novel, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman, where mere sidesteps became the show. I end my book with a storm surrounding me. The style in this book can be seen as a distant ancestor of the first storyteller in a cave or the ancient Jewish prophets. Lawrence Stern later developed it as a literary form in Tristram Shandy, written in 1759. With these influences in mind, I've become known for my stream of consciousness radio stories, and this book captures some of these streams. That's it. It's sparse. My nonfiction is sparse because I grew up learning the art of science writing. I had to write science papers, and I learned to write in writing a science paper, the first rule is use as few words as possible. Number one rule, use as few words as possible. Don't waste words. And frankly, that's why I think my radio show has worked all these years. Although I speak a lot, I try to be as succinct as I can. You know, talk about morbidity. My first autopsy. There it is. Well, I don't want to read it. I'm not in the book. Sam the Butcher, Dead Man's. Everyone likes Dead Man's Pants because it's a sad but comedic story. But you haven't really heard the electric blue saddle-stitched pants very well, but I don't want to read it right now. I want to take your calls on the Savage Nation, but unfortunately I don't have the time. Could you believe it? You know, when you're having a good time in talk radio, as I am right now, even though I have a minor migraine, even though I feel the other side clamping, must be a weather change coming in. I predict the wettest winter in 15 years coming into Northern California. Did I tell you that I can predict weather? Every year I've gotten it right. I'm better than a woodchuck. No, what's the animal that comes out of the earth, Beowulf, that they, that predicts? Groundhog. Yeah, I have a better predictor than the groundhog. When it comes to weather. No, the summer was so hot, it was like being in you-know-where itself. It didn't end. It just didn't
Savage.
End.
Savage.
Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name. Oh, yeah. But what's confusing you is just the nature of my name.
It is the Savage Nation. We shift gears from the political to the personal. The political to the personal. Who has not seen the movie The Original Showgirls, 1995? Who has not seen Basic Instinct, 1992, with the famous Sharon Stone scene? Well, most of you, but there's other movies. And the screenwriter is Joe Esterhaus. And Joe has written a new book, and it's all about his, I guess, discovery of God. I don't know how else to put it, or some would say born again, if you want to put it to you that way. You know, God's always been there. It's just that many of us don't know that. And people would say, what, from Showgirls to God, from Basic Instinct to Paul? My answer is, why not? Why exclude anyone from themselves, you know, and from reality? So, Joe Esterhaus, welcome to the Savage Nation with your new book, Crossbearer. Joe, welcome to the program, and thanks for being on the air with us.
Thank you, Michael. Nice to be here.
I'm very amazed at what you've been through to go from Malibu back to the area in Cleveland because your children were young. I loved your opening, which tells it all. I mean, because I live in California and I raise children here and I know the temptations. I'm going to read it if you don't mind. This is how I found God, or how God found me. In March of 01, Naomi and I moved our boys back to Ohio, where she and I had grown up. We wanted the boys to live in a more traditional environment. Hypodermic needles were being found in the Malibu Park where our boys were playing. Police said there was a heroin problem among 13-year-olds. 10-year-old little girls were chatting about gangbangs. And then you moved to Ohio, and boom, then you're diagnosed with throat cancer. And you've been smoking since you're 12, 14, drinking, and now you're 56. So you beat the cancer, did you, Joe?
Yes, I have. And this was 7 years ago. And 7 years down the line, my doctor told me that he actually used the word cured, which, as you know, oncologists don't use. And he said it was a miracle of lifestyle over disease.
A miracle. And, you know, I can't be too logical in this, but I read a lot of it because of a lot of different reasons. One of the things that interests me in your writing was how you fueled your writing with drugs, sex, and rock and roll, basically. I mean, if I'm not trying to be, you know, a wise guy here, but that's more or less what you said. Isn't that true?
It's true.
Okay. That's what you said. So are you still writing today? And if you are, what are you using to fuel yourself?
Well, for 2 years, I literally couldn't write because from the time I was really young, when I was at Rolling Stone, you know, I would chain smoke and I would sip something while I was writing. And when I stopped, with God's help, I couldn't write for 2 years. And then it gradually became easier. This book is one of the first things that I started to write. I began it in 2003. I couldn't get it right. I couldn't get the tone right. The juxtapositions between things that were moving and poignant and things that were funny didn't work, and I stopped and started taking notes. In about 2006, I started writing it again, and then gradually it worked, and I got the tone right. I had a terrific editor at St. Martin's Press who sort of forced me back.
But Joe, you were doing this, of course, without drugs and without alcohol, right?
The first time since I was very young that I was writing anything without either cigarettes or booze next to me.
Well, that leads to the next question. So what helps you focus without those drugs?
You know, it's remarkable how good you feel when you've never been lucid and never been clean. I began walking each day. I walk 5 miles every day to stay in Cleveland. It gets cold in the winter, and I do that as well. The walks really help to keep me straight. And truthfully, without proselytizing or being a missionary, the presence of God in my life really helped keep me straight. And I was able gradually to start writing without anything there. These things had always been my little friends and crutches, Michael. And no one really knew about these things, including Naomi. But suddenly, without them, I was once again able to write again.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You know, to be honest with you, there's a lot in the book that has to do with Hollywood. And, of course, I, like everyone else, am interested in, Hollywood. I'm a big movie watcher, mainly in bed. I was just talking earlier on the show about a great movie I saw last night called Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, directed by Sidney Lumet. Did you ever see that one, by the way, just as a side note?
It's Sidney's most recent movie. Remarkable movie, independently made, very powerful, I think. Sidney's one of the underrated directors in America, I think, to do that at his age.
It's unbelievable. You know. But Albert Finney steals the show, and he isn't even given any credit when you read about the movie. But having said that, so I watch a lot of movies. So I'm reading your book, Crossbearer, and there's certain things in it that really struck me as interesting that I think the audience would like to know about. Because I had Mel Gibson on a couple of years ago as he was promoting, The Passion of the Christ. He invited me to his office, and we watched the movie together. He was really a nice guy, and I helped promote it for him. And, of course, I know all of the sequel. I know the whole story. We all do. But in your book, you write that Mel's movie, The Passion of Christ, seems to you to be an adaptation of a book called The Dolorous Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ by an 18th century German nun and mystic named Anne Catherine Emmerich. And the reason you say that Mel Gibson doesn't mention that is not so much because he's trying to rip her off, is because he didn't want the connections to her anti-Semitism to come out. Isn't that really what you're saying?
Yes, in a sense, I was saying that. I also said that I loved The Passion of the Christ, and I saw it 7 times, and I view the movie as a prayer. I thought it was that powerful. But yes, I did say those things about Anne Catherine Emmerich.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to nail anyone to anything. I'm not a gotcha kind of guy. Not on the radio anyway, just in my personal life. Then there's another couple of sentences in here that I underline. You say that you're talking to an agent in Hollywood who was representing a project called From Saul to Paul, and you were real anxious to be the writer on that one after you had found God again. And you told this agent all about your spiritual rebirth, and you said you could put your heart and soul into it, and he laughs at you, and he says, from showgirls to God, from basic instinct to Paul, and he wouldn't give you the job. I mean, that's a pretty amazing story.
Well, it is. There was another story that's not in the book that you might enjoy that's similar to that, and I know that somebody said you had Sly Stallone on your show. Sly and I, we did Fist together, and we did Burn Hollywood Burn together, and then about 1998, he came to my house, and he had an idea of doing a movie about a televangelist. And I thought it was a really interesting idea, Reverend Knight kind of televangelist. And I like Sly very much. So we went to have a meeting with Ed Universal, and Ron Meyer, who was the head of Universal, was there. And it was after lunch, and Ronnie listened to our story. Sly sort of acted out the roles, and I talked about what the story would be. And Ron said, wait a minute, guys. He said, Sly, you've been the biggest action movie star in the world, and you want to be a televangelist. And Joe, you've just done Showgirls, and you want to write the script for this. He said, guys, the segue is too harsh. Let's give it some time.
that is funny. No, I like Stallone. A little bit I met him. He's a great guy. I actually like this movie. The plot was very daring, actually, when you think about his last movie, because he takes on the Burmese murderers in a way that Hollywood should have supported him for that, and they still basically gave him the middle finger. They just don't like him, I guess. In your book, talking about, you know, finding God and crying and giving up, you know, your control freak nature and all of that, I guess because of the cancer, is that why? I mean, is that why you found God? Because you felt you were going to die and you asked God to save you?
It's part of it. It was the first time in my life that I felt I was powerless. It was the most desolate moment of my life. You know, I didn't like turning for help all of my life to anybody, partly because I'm an immigrant and I came in when I was 6 years old. My parents couldn't speak the English language, so I became a kind of liaison to this new world, which is a lot of power for a little kid. And I think from that time on, I was really a kind of control freak, and it worked against me in many ways. But at this particular moment, I knew that I couldn't do this by myself. And even though from the time that I was a boy, I turned against God and that marginalized God and people who believed in God, I had this thought that ran across my through my head because I couldn't speak. I had a trach, and the thought was, please, God, help me. You know, and I asked God to help me at the most desolate moment of my life. Incidentally, I think that's what happens to most people, and I think it's absolutely fine in that moment when we can't help ourselves and we know we can't. That's the moment when we turn to God, and I think it's totally justified and real and human, very, very human.
Absolutely. I don't see hypocrisy. People don't understand that. You know, the old pat phrase, there are no atheists in a foxhole. Let's start with that one. But I remember in my own life when my father got a heart attack when he was young, in his 40s. I was a young kid. I remember everyone was crying and yelling and screaming and whatever. And I think my uncle came around and he said, all of a sudden, everyone's asking for God's help. Something along those lines. It was sort of, you know, cynical or sarcastic in its own way. But, yeah, I mean, that's when you call out to God. When do most people, do they call out when they're feeling good and they're winning on the roulette wheel? I don't know.
I agree with you, Michael. That's exactly what happened. What's interesting, it happened 7 years ago, and I felt something enter my heart and enter my soul that's made my life, that's brightened my life, and I'm happier than I've ever been. I've deepened my faith. That's how I started to try and pray, and I had difficulty because I didn't know how. And ultimately, you know, that's how I started carrying a cross at church, which is the spine of the book. Because I looked at all these people carrying crosses, and they're doing stuff like chewing gum and looking at their friends and winking and all this stuff as they went to the altar. And I thought, well, this is not good. I can do this better. So I asked to carry it, and I did. And I hope that I do it with the kind of gravitas that says, yes, I will carry Christ's cross and Christ on the cross to make his burden easier and also to ease my own, you know. And then I
all right, so, but everyone listening to this show probably could remember the movie Showgirls or Basic Instinct, or they heard about it. And you were, at the time, probably one of the most highly paid screenwriters, weren't you? I mean, you were making millions of dollars a screenplay, right, Joe?
Yes, I was.
Okay, I mean, that's something to be proud of. You made millions of dollars in a really competitive field. And then you write in this book, I will tell Hollywood that it's not enough for us to make uplifting movies about just and righteous political causes. We also have to stop making movies that literally kill people.
That's right.
And, of course, you become a big campaigner against smoking, which I understand. But what about every movie I watch? Every movie I watched through the 80s, and I noted it happening, showed a young star or starlet with a pistol in her or his hand. I watched every movie poster, had a young, punky-looking, you know, kind of, you know, I don't, every starlet had a gun in her hand. What about the violence that's projected in the movies? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that the violence is real. Violence happens. Violence is in the Bible. Violence is in our lives. I agree with you as the father of four little boys, where a movie is rated PG-13, and we go to see it as a family, and there is that kind of violence in it. And I say to myself, as the dad, why does it always have to be violence? Why do there have to be sexual innuendos and all of these things with the PG-13 rating? I think the rating is the issue. At this point, I think that the PG-13 ratings have become so liquefied that they are really R ratings of a few years ago, and I think that exposing kids to that non-ending violence, and I agree with that part of what you're saying, to expose kids to it, you know, has a very harmful effect.
Yeah, and the sexuality. I see little girls in the mall with their mothers at 12. They're dressing like showgirls. And worse, you know, they look like they could play Sharon Stone's role in Basic Instinct, half the kids 12 years old here in Marin County, which I know you're familiar with because I read that you once lived in San Rafael before you left from Malibu. But Joe Estherhouse, I want to ask another question of you because the book is interesting. You know, look, all men's journeys are interesting. In essence, whatever your religion is, we're all carrying a cross one way or the other. And we all have to get through it one way or the other. And it doesn't matter whether you're Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, or Hindu. The fact of the matter is life is a struggle for every person on earth. It's not a picnic. That we know. These are pat phrases that I heard when I was a kid, but it's all true. The question is, how do you carry that burden without, you know, resorting to the drug, sex, and rock and roll? How do you do it without becoming a fanatic? And more than that, here you go from Malibu to save the kids from the horrible degeneracy that you see around there. You move back to a small town outside of Cleveland where you grew up with your wife and four sons, and boom, you go to church, you find God, you go to church, and the priest is then removed from the parish because he was molesting boys. That's utterly unbelievable to me that would hit you that way, and you still didn't lose your faith. And the minute I come back on the Savage Nation, I'd love for you to say what you wrote in the book as to why, although this priest was, you know, removed from the church, a guy you really respected for child molestation, you still didn't lose your faith in God. I'll be right back with Joe Esterhaus and his new book, Cross Bearer, right here on the Savage Nation. Please be here. This is the Savage Nation. We're speaking with Joe Esterhaus, screenwriter extraordinaire. He wrote Showgirls, Basic Instinct, many other famous movies. But terrible things happened to him after he left Hollywood to get away from the degeneracy, to raise his children in a quiet town outside of Cleveland where he grew up. He gets a diagnosis of throat cancer. Cleveland Clinic removes 80% of his larynx. He gets a tracheotomy tube, and he's told to give up drinking and smoking. Now, I want to read from page 43. He says, was this my just and deserved karma? Joe writes, I knew a Hollywood mogul who killed a man and stole his wife and fortune and got away with it. One day, years later, he was lying down on a Caribbean beach and someone on a construction crane behind him dropped an iron rod. It went straight through the mogul's heart. God had put a stake through his heart. And I knew a movie star who had sex with at least two women every day and brutally dumped and abandoned all of them. He got cancer of the scrotum. The doctors had to remove his testicles. God had cut his you-know-whats off. Joe, this is pretty powerful stuff. What do you think the meaning of all of your struggles is all about?
I'm sorry, I missed what you said, Michael.
What is the meaning of you having suffered like this?
Well, I've said to my wife a lot that maybe God kept me alive to raise four beautiful boys. And to raise them to manhood. And my wife argues with me and says, no, I think God kept you alive to be a witness to what you've gone through, to write this book, and to tell the world that people should open their hearts and to be ready to receive God into their hearts. And I think that's certainly a good part of why I'm alive. In the book, I detail 20 other incidents that should have killed me. And, you know, I sort of feel like Keith Richards and I'm still alive. I don't think that was all so that I could write Basic Instinct and Showgirls in retrospect. I think there was a greater meaning to it than that.
Well, yeah, I understand. I understand all of that. How do your friends in Hollywood, I mean, you must have friends in Hollywood who still drink and smoke and do the things you used to do. Do they consider you a Jesus freak and laugh at you behind your back or what?
I think that truly, I think that most of them think that he somehow lost his mind. I refer to Tony Blair in the book, who said that when he was the Prime Minister of England, he never talked about his faith, which is a very deep and intense faith, because he was afraid that people would view him as a nutter. Well, I'm afraid I've become Tony Blair's fellow nutter, but I felt that I had to tell what happened to me simply to say thank you for being alive.
Well, thank you for being alive is a great phrase, because there's a saying in the Jewish tradition called to life, and certainly a religion that affirms life by saying to life is a good way to look at things. Crossbearer, a memoir of faith, Joe Esterhaus, I wish you success, and I wish you most success in raising your boys, because that, of course, is the greatest challenge and the greatest job that we all have.
Can I wish you two things before I go?
Yes.
Okay. I wish you keep up the good fight, and God bless America. Thank you, Michael.
Joe Esterhaus, thanks for the
thank you.
Thanks. I was going to say the next time you're in San Rafael, give me a call. We'll go out for a Corona, but he doesn't. I think he uses cheese whizzes now. New York, Al, we have time for one last caller. Al, welcome from WOR. What's on your mind?
Michael, my Dutch uncle. How are you?
Hi.
Don't ask that question. Got the book today in the mail.
And, yes.
Excited to read a story, My Silent Brother.
Did you read it?
No, I didn't read it yet. I grew up with a silent sister in my house. And
Oh, my God. Yep. That's chilling. My legs just got that vibe again when you said it. I try not to talk too much about it because people will think you're just milking them for sympathy. But my story, My Silent Brother, is pretty touching. And it affected, you know, my every life, my every day, every breath, every second of my life and my view of life. And there it is. I am mordant. I am not morbid. I've been instructed I am mordant, biting, pungent, from the Latin mordent. This is the Savage Nation. Be here.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Springy kind of mood. I don't know what it is. My seasons are all off, but I thought of this song just now. Even though we're going into like autumn and winter, I feel like it's springtime. And you know why? I know why, because this election will be over. To me, it'll be like the beginning of a new life. I'll be born again after this election is over. I'll be able to do radio again without talking about these two clowns. I've never seen anything like it. Obama's espousing absolute communist blatherings day and night. You know, trickle-up poverty is communism. Spread the wealth, communism. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, communism. And here they are espousing the same garbage, and they're not called on it. And I know why. They're not called on it for one reason. It's the same reason McCain won't come on this show. Because his campaign manager, Rick Davis, is it? Is it Rick Davis? It turns out is a lobbyist who lobbied on behalf of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the year 2000. So, you know, what do you think? I was born yesterday. You think I don't know that both parties are two heads of the same monster? Oh, wait a minute. Here's what I was trying to get at. Weekend Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal from the weekend. I found a story that's a mind blower. Here it is. This you're not going to believe. I hope I have the time to develop this. This is so good. It's about the dictatorship that we have now being run by one man, Hank Paulson, of the Treasury Department. The articles from the Wall Street Journal from the weekend. Obscure tax breaks increase cost of financial rescue. And you got to look at it carefully. And it shows John Stumpf Center, a CEO of Wells Fargo, which is expected to save billions on its Wachovia purchase due to changes in treatment of losses. And you read carefully, listen to this. In a one-sentence ruling issued on September 30th, one-sentence ruling, the Treasury Department effectively lifted the restriction that if the company being bought is a bank and the losses are attributable to a portfolio of loans, they get a tax write-off, okay? So Senator Charles Grassley, the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, has complained about the sudden loosening of the rules. He said Congress should have been informed and consulted before Treasury took such an extraordinary action that likely will add billions of dollars to the deficit. So the Treasury Department, under the dictator Paulson, changes tax laws, which is totally illegal. Robert Willens, an independent corporate tax analyst, says it doesn't seem possible that Treasury has this authority, but it doesn't matter. Now, what is this? Under the old rules, Wells Fargo would have been limited to annual tax deductions stemming from the Wachovia losses of roughly $930 million over the next 20 years, or a total of $18.6 billion. Wells Fargo, under the new rule written overnight, will now be able to use all $74 billion in losses. That will likely mean additional tax savings to Wells Fargo of about $19.4 billion, or more than the total purchase price for Wachovia's common stock, currently about $14.3 billion. Now, let me stop right there. It sounds very complicated. The Treasury Secretary, Paulson, who has done nothing but insider legislation from the day he came to Washington, in my opinion, along with the corrupt, rotten Charles Schumer, the rotten, corrupt Charles Schumer, who raised questions about IndyMac Bancorp and caused a run on the first collapsed bank in America. Schumer, in my opinion, should be investigated by the FBI. Certainly, Paulson should be investigated for his ties to the cronies who are benefiting from rules he's writing as he goes along. He's writing them on the fly. So the bailout is a bailout, but it's not a bailout for us. It's a bailout for his rich fat cat friends on Wall Street and in the banking industry. So I hope you understand what I just said to you. He wrote a one-sentence ruling issued on September 30th. He lifts a restriction that will save his friends at Wells Fargo about $19.4 billion, which is more than the total purchase price for Wachovia's common stock, currently about $14.3 billion. How can a Treasury secretary change a tax law to benefit a specific individual in a specific bank? Answer, who's going to stop him? If we have a government, a Congress more specifically, that has, in essence, abdicated its responsibilities, which it has, when you see a low-life loser moron like Barney Frank acting like a financial wizard when you know the man could not even run a souvlaki stand in Manhattan and make a dollar, you understand the trouble we're in. When you see corrupt Democrats and corrupt Republicans applauding about a bailout, which doesn't work, and then they bail out another one, then they bail out again. Now they're talking about another bailout. The reason is because they're not bailing you out. They're bailing themselves out, their companies out, and their friends out. Do you understand that? And that's why I say, ladies and gentlemen, I can't take it anymore. We the people have lost our country. We've lost our government. George Bush put a stake through the heart of America's liberty through his inarticulateness, which I think is an act, through his acts that make no sense whatsoever, through spreading the wealth around the world with money that is not his to do, through crony capitalism. We now have a situation that I don't know can be recovered from. I don't know. I don't know that anybody can save us anymore. I think it's too far gone. Now, where it ends, nobody knows. Around and around it goes. Where it ends, nobody knows. I know this. I'll be right back. Savage. Hollywood's liberal bias is well known. You know, the simple fact is that if you don't believe in the liberal talking points, you had better keep quiet about it, or it's going to be real hard to find work in Hollywood. Our next guest, Andrew Klavan, is a screenwriter and the author of such best-selling novels as True Crime, which was filmed by Clint Eastwood. It was a great movie. And Don't Say a Word, film starring Michael Douglas. He joins us now to talk about his newest book, Empire of Lies, and to talk about being a conservative living in the heart of liberal California. Andrew Klavan, it's an honor to have you on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Well, so tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, Empire of Lies is, first of all, it's about a conservative Christian man in the Midwest who is forced to come back to the scenes of his kind of degraded liberal youth in New York. And he starts to think he's uncovered an Islamo-fascist conspiracy, but he gets so immersed in the biased left-wing media that he begins to doubt his own sanity. So the novel becomes a kind of race against time. Can he uncover this conspiracy and at the same time dig into his own troubled past and his troubled mind to see if he's going insane? And the reason I wrote it is because I really got tired of a world, not just in Hollywood, but also in publishing, in which all the background assumptions of our stories are essentially liberal. Essentially, we're supposed to think that all cultures are the same, that all religions are equal, that all ideas are the same. And that very culture, which is what I call the empire of lies, becomes a character in the novel and becomes kind of one of the villains of the piece, trying to lead our hero away from the truth.
Well, this is exactly what's going on today on TV and the movies.
It's incredible, and it's just total nonsense. It's this idea that somehow there's some moral equivalence between a free society that sometimes makes mistakes and a society that is based on the philosophy of theocracy, of imposing your ideas on other people, of killing people who disagree, of suppressing women. There's no moral equivalence there, and yet Hollywood thinks that by telling those lies, they somehow make themselves seem better, more tolerant. You know, I believe that we need a culture, works of art, that tell the truth, that simply show the world as it is. And I think that one of the problems we have is that conservatives have kind of turned their back on the culture. They complain about Hollywood. They complain about the kind of novels that come out. But they don't do anything about it. They don't create new movies and new novels that actually speak the truth. And they don't create a system that rewards artists of awards and reviews and praise, which is what artists work for, that rewards artists on the right. All those things, the awards, the reviewers, they're all left-wing. And the minute you step outside the orthodoxy, as I did with Empire of Lies, you get tagged. You know, the Associated Press called me a right-wing crackpot. That was their review of my novel. And whenever somebody steps outside the orthodoxy, they're going to meet those kind of reviews, and we need to set up alternative reviews that praise right-wing works.
The main character, Jason Harrow, how much of yourself is in him?
Well, he's got a much more troubled mind and a troubled past than I do, thankfully. But we share a couple of things. He has a sense of humor that I recognize as mine. He is he becomes a Christian after a certain period in his life, as I did. So there are similarities. Usually what you do is you take little pieces of yourself and you use them as yeast to bring characters to life. But it's not autobiographical.
How do you stay sane being a conservative living in the heart of the liberal capital of the world?
It's an amazing situation. In Hollywood, when you go into a meeting, a business meeting, trying to sell a story or trying to get hired as a writer, people in the room, the executives, the producers, they think nothing about bashing Bush, about bashing American foreign policy, more than anything about bashing conservatives in general. Whereas conservatives are holding secret meetings where they get together and sort of whisper their beliefs to each other just to hear them out loud. And that's how slanted the system is. And the reason is the people are afraid, conservatives are afraid, that if they express their opinions out loud, they won't get hired. That there's not a blacklist, maybe, but a gray list that makes it more difficult to get hired. And I've certainly experienced some of that. I think since I've come out and since I've been speaking as openly as I have, I know that some of my jobs have disappeared, and there are phone calls I don't get. And it's a shame that conservatives have to worry about that. And the other thing they worry about that really is disturbing is they worry about being called hateful. They worry if they transgress against liberal orthodoxy, they'll be called racist or sexist or Islamophobic, because those are the tools that the left uses, that name-calling, to keep conservatives in line. So there are a lot of things in Hollywood militating against conservative artists coming out and speaking openly. But I think it has to be done, because if we lose the culture, you know, we can win the Congress, we can win the White House, we can win the Supreme Court. If we lose the culture, ultimately we lose the country, because the culture drips its ideas slowly into the consciousness of the nation. And for the last 30 years, those ideas have been poison, to my mind, and we need to take that culture back.
It seems to me that there's a growing trend in Hollywood and elsewhere that people are beginning to stand up and speak out for their political beliefs. Is that true?
It's happening slowly. It definitely is happening. And I think we're going to reach critical mass, and ultimately we're going to win this argument. The problem is when the culture eats away at our confidence in our values and in our country, then when the Islamofascists come in, not just with violent attacks, but with that soft jihad of lawsuits and cultural attacks, we have nothing to fight them with, because we'll have lost confidence in what we are. We need art and a culture that reinforces the values of the Constitution and the values of the West, so that when these guys come in from their failed societies and say that our successful society should be more like theirs, we can say, no, we're not going to do that, because we know what we believe in and why we believe it.
Your characters have such a gritty depth to them that they seem to increase the sense of realism to me. Is that something you consciously focus on?
One of the things I'm concerned about is that as long as conservatives call for squeaky clean stories, as long as they call for heroes who are simplistic and say, oh, we just want to see stories about right and wrong where everything is very clear, as long as we do that, the left is going to own the culture. I want to tell real stories about real people with real depth that have conservative values and a conservative point of view, because the first rule of conservatism is that people are not perfectible. They have flaws. They have hidden corners. And I show my heroes and my villains as deeply as I possibly can to show you why in the real world there are certain values that work and certain ones that don't. So I think it's really important, and especially in thrillers, because I love thrillers. I think thrillers are a wonderful vehicle for showing the world, because they give you heroes who have to race against time to find out what reality is. And I think that's what all of us have to do in our lives. this novel really is different. You know, I'm not just saying it. And if you pick up this book and read even the first three pages, you'll see that you're listening to a voice you have not heard before in mainstream fiction. And I think it'll catch you, and I think it'll pull you in. And that is the one thing I'd really like to say to people, because it's right there, right on the first page and right through the book.
A lot of the media seem to focus on fluff pieces of news like Britney's clothes or Paris's acting to keep us entertained. Is there hope for the media in our society, in your opinion? Do you think they're ever going to get any better than they are?
I think the entire country, especially our media, is in a state of denial. I think they turn to stories, silly stories like, you know, global warming as a crisis and, you know, Britney Spears and whether she's wearing underwear, to take away from something that really is going on, which is that our values are under assault around the world and within our own country. And I think that as long as they can keep us kind of, you know, goggling after the latest starlet and worried about what car we drive and what light bulb we use, it takes away from the real values that we need to be talking about, the values of the West like tolerance and honor and duty that we've kind of let go by the boards for a lot of superficiality and frivolousness. Listen, I like a pretty girl and a pretty starlet as much as anybody, and there's nothing wrong with some of that, but I do think the mainstream media keeps up a kind of steady drumbeat to detract, to take your eye off the ball, to take your eye off the real issues that are facing the country.
What's your opinion as to what the country needs to do to get back on the right track?
Well, I think the thing is that conservatives especially need to stop complaining and start creating. I think we've done this in a lot of ways. We've done it with think tanks that deal with political issues. We've done it with talk radio that has countered the mainstream media and the news. We need to do it more, and we need to do it fearlessly. And finally, we need to do it in the arts. The arts at this point are a wholly owned subsidiary of the left. And as I keep saying, if we lose the arts, we lose the minds of the people. And so we need to speak out fearlessly without being afraid of being called names. We're going to be called racist. We're going to be called sexist. We're going to be called hateful. We need to just speak our truth without hate and say what it is we see. And once we do that, once we show that we're not afraid, that the people who can speak and can create are not afraid, then other people will stop being afraid too. I really feel that conservatives have developed a sort of cultural cringe where they walk around terrified that somebody's going to call them a name or even that they're going to lose their job for something they said. And we need to speak out against that. We need to speak out every time somebody is censored. We need to speak out every time the New York Times refuses to print something because it might offend Islamofascists. We need to present our opinion honestly and directly and keep the values of the West alive.
Andrew Klavan, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thanks a lot, Michael. It's been great talking to you.
The liberal media seems happy to speak on behalf of our troops, but rarely do we get to hear their own voices, that is, of the troops. Former Navy SEAL Dick Couch has written a book called Chosen Soldier, The Making of a Special Forces Warrior, about how our elite forces are trained to fight behind enemy lines, and I don't mean in Manhattan, and what life is really like for them. Mr. Couch, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Mike. It's great to be on your show today. I appreciate talking with you.
Tell us about your background.
Well, I am pleased to be a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. I served aboard ship before I went into the Navy underwater demolition and SEAL teams. Served there for 5 years, and then after leaving there, I was a paramilitary case officer with the CIA for a period of time. I began my writing career in 1990, and it's continued right on up through the present.
Why did you write this particular book?
The Chosen Soldier is about Army Special Forces, and I'm a Navy guy, and so having gone through Navy SEAL training back when I was on active duty, and I went through the process again with The Warrior Elite, a book I wrote back in 1999 and 2000. I'm very interested in special operations training, and I wanted to see how the Army trained their special warriors, specifically special forces, because they're a very important component of our special operations community and certainly a very important component in our war on terrorism.
How long did you spend with the special forces?
Well, I in 2004, my wife and I, we left our our mountain home in Idaho, and we went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and we lived there for a year. We lived out on Camp McCall, which is a Special Forces training base. They were very nice to let me into their world, and every morning or whenever, I went out and watched them in classes, participated in their training, and sometimes at night I'd be out there following these guys through the swamps of North Carolina, observing them as they trained and prepared for this. Special Forces training can take anywhere from a year to 2 years, depending upon the language specialty and certain disciplines that they're taught, but it takes a long time to make one of these guys. It's an expensive process, and only about one who enters finishes.
What is it that the Special Forces actually do?
Army Special Forces, these are the Green Berets. They can do a whole bunch of things. They have a broad range of skills, military skills, including communications, medicine, weapons, that type of thing. But what their really strong suit is, they are teachers. Their job is to train other soldiers, other armies, our allies, to be more effective soldiers. So they have a great deal of leverage on the battlefield in that they can train others to fight. And so that's their skill set. They're also masters at cross-cultural disciplines. They all have language capabilities. They're very good with other cultures. They're very good working by themselves out someplace with a bunch of indigenous troops. So that's why they're very important soldiers and very much needed in our current situation.
What is a typical day like in Afghanistan for these soldiers?
Well, I think a typical day for a Special Forces soldiers is probably going to be, you know, briefing up with his team, what are they going to do today, or what's the next operation, or how are they doing things. And then typically, two of these guys or four of these guys or more will go off, collect their platoon or company of Afghan irregulars or Iraqi Army scouts, and they will perhaps go through some training. Now, training in these foreign cultures, sometimes they only work 3 or 4 hours a day, or they do these things. But basically, they're out there working with them, teaching military skills. It could be they're out on operations, whereas that those Afghan irregulars are doing a sweep or a patrol through an area. These special, maybe there could be 30 or 40 of them and two American soldiers with them to help and advise and guide and be a resource for them as they go about their duties.
Well, it sounds like they have quite a big emphasis on teaching and learning.
Absolutely. Now, these soldiers can fight. They have good small unit tactic skills. Many of them are former Rangers. Most of them are combat veterans, either in the conventional forces or in Army Special Forces. So they've been around a while. The average age of a deployed Special Forces A-team is probably around 30 to 32 years old. So these are very experienced soldiers.
Well, they also gather intelligence as well, don't they?
That certainly falls in there. Don't forget, they're working closely with the indigenous people. They're helping not only the soldiers, but seeing to their families, paying them. They have very good capabilities to provide medical services to the indigenous people, including their families. And when they do these types, they could be living in a village in Afghanistan or in a small area, small village in Iraq, and they will help the extended community. And for that help, these people often will confide in them, tell them things that maybe don't come through normal intelligence or normal reporting channels. So as far as human intelligence, and that's the best kind, the people on the ground, the people who live there, they're very good at gathering this type of intelligence and either acting upon it themselves or passing it along for other units to act upon.
How are soldiers selected for the Special Forces? Can anyone do it?
Well, in selecting them, and that's what Chosen Soldiers is about, how do you select and train these people? They're looking for three things. They're looking for men who are tough, who can live in hard conditions and survive there. They're looking for guys who are smart. Intelligence is a key factor in Special Forces, any forces for that matter, but it's very important that they have the intelligence to master the military skills, foreign languages, and to become aware and function in a cross-cultural environment. And the third thing is they have to play well with others, and that's generic for some people just want to be fighters. They just want to be with their mates and get behind the gun and go out and do their job, and that's well and good. But other people, what the Special Forces is looking for are people who like other people, who get on well with others. Your quintessential Special Forces sergeant will go out and stop a car driving down the road to meet and talk to a perfect stranger. They engage other people. They're very good at it. That's a part of their job.
All we see in the movies about Special Forces is about the ways they can kill people and blow stuff up. How come we don't see what they can really do?
Well, that's a good question. I think that, you know, we live in a visual world, and good film cuts are sort of what you want. Sometimes working in a community, helping others, training them in military skills, helping them with their schools, helping them buy books, seeing to their medical problems, sometimes getting Iraqis and Afghanis to fight and help and do the right thing means you have to show them you care, which means you function within their community, and their problems become your problems. This is kind of boring stuff in the way we Americans look and picture war, but it's deadly serious business and very effective when it's done properly by basically American fighting men who can go out and live with others and help them to become better fighting men.
Well, the Special Forces seem like one of the most essential groups of soldiers we have fighting over there.
Absolutely. I mean, if the key ingredient of our getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan is that they can pick up the load and do the job, that means they can defeat the insurgent elements, they can control some of the almost criminal elements that live among them. These are things they have to be able to do so that they can have a functioning society and we can leave. Well, the stock and trade of Army Special Forces is to help them become better at the military duties and counterinsurgency disciplines they have to master so we can go home. We don't spend enough attention studying foreign other cultures and learning how to help them function and defeat our common enemies. We in the American military are very good at maneuver warfare, and you know, we can take an armored column into about any capital in the world and take it over. But what happens after that? Al-Qaeda and some of the of those types of people, they're very good at using piggybacking on insurgencies, terrorizing, intimidating people, and theirs is a tyranny of the minority. And we need to work very hard at having a military that can function in a counterinsurgency environment and helping our allies and indigenous people defeat our common enemies. And that's why Army Special Forces and all our special operations forces are so very important in accomplishing these goals.
Dick Couch, it's been an honor. Thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Mike, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
Savage.
The Savage Nation. Trickle Up Poverty, The New Economics of Barack Obama, was posted Wednesday, October 15, 2008, which my loyal listeners know was created by Michael Savage specifically for John McCain to use in the debate against Barack Obama as the knockout punch. Whether McCain got it, I doubt, because he's being managed, in my opinion, by a saboteur, an enemy within, who has lobbied his campaign advisor. McCain's campaign advisor is a known lobbyist who lobbied for Freddie and Fannie. That means he's in with the Democrats. Don't you understand what's going on here? Every time McCain gets up, this guy knocks him down. This is the same guy who's telling him not to go on the Savage Nation. This is the same guy who lobbied for Freddie and Fannie. I mean, how much clearer does it have to be? Now, for McCain to not understand that his own campaign manager may be a Brutus indicates that McCain may not know very much about anything, frankly. And that's worrisome, frankly. So we're trapped here. Do we elect Obama? We let him get elected? A known socialist, Marxist, slash anarchist Obama with almost three quarters of a trillion dollars raised Some of it has to be from foreign governments or foreign sources, bundled by Democrat operatives. Logic would tell us that. Do we let him get elected, or do we elect this dodo bird here? We don't know what to do. Nobody knows what to do. What a choice we have here. You talk about a Hobson's choice. And then I raise the other issue. Look at my lead story from Bloomberg on MichaelSavage.com. Obama relies on black pride for record numbers. Fine. They say Obama can count on winning up to 95% of black voters. That's their right. But it raises this question. The question is, the only people who don't seem to vote based on race are white people of European origin. Why not? Doesn't it trouble you that other races nakedly embrace their own race when they run for office, but that whites think that that's wrong? Does that tell you something about the white people of European origin? It should. It should, for God's sakes. And then I read you the blockbuster story today on the Savage Nation that I think no one heard. I wish it was up on my website. It's from you better get a copy of this on my website. Saturday, Sunday, October 18, 19, 2008, Wall Street Journal, by Jesse Drucker. Obscure tax breaks increase cost of financial rescue. You have to read this story. If you're intelligent, you have to ask, how could the Treasury Department rewrite tax rules in a one-sentence ruling issued on September 30th that benefits a specific bank, meaning Wells Fargo, that will save Wells Fargo $19.4 billion, or more than the total purchase price for Wachovia's common stock, currently about $14.3 billion. How is that possible? How could the Treasury Department shift from administering parts of the tax code to changing tax law on its own? They do not have this authority, according to experts. And how could they rewrite tax laws for one specific bank? It seems to me to be illegal. Who do I turn to ask for an investigation? Answer, nobody. There's nobody left to turn to. Raymond in New York on WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation. How do you feel about Paulson writing tax laws for one bank?
I think it's outrageous. I think Paulson is single-handedly destroying the United States, and the people that are behind him are looking to pick up the pieces afterwards once it's all destroyed. It's horrible. Michael, I have to say that I'm also a graduate, and I like the kinship with you.
Well, I'm sorry, I missed that. You're a graduate of who?
Jamaica High School, and I like the kinship with you.
What year did you graduate?
85.
Oh, you're a baby.
But you know, I like
when I went to Jamaica High School, I would say that the rigorous nature of a high school education when I was there was easily equal to one of the finest colleges in America today in terms of what we had to study and how we were tested and prodded and challenged and insulted if we didn't do well, better than most colleges today.
We had the school chancellor, Bob McEnroe, I think it was many years ago, that had said that we were one of the best schools in all of New York City.
I can't speak to that. It's been so long since I was a student there, but I know it was pretty tough. What did you major in college, Raymond?
Art and advertising.
Advertising. Okay, my friend. Thank you for calling. We have time for a few more calls here on the Savage Nation. Phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Who stole the phrase trickle up poverty, and who used it unashamedly on radio? If you know who stole my phrase trickle up poverty, call Michael Savage at 1-800-449-8255 on our 9/11 hotline, which is 1-800-449-8255, because the only way to get this to stop and to get these people who are ripping me off for my ideas is to embarrass them. You should flood that guy's phone calls tomorrow, his phone bank, and say, shame on you. That's what you should do. Truthfully, I really believe you should. Chicago, Peter, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I consider myself a mordant optimist myself, and I was fascinated by your discussion. And what I thought is sort of a corollary to that is that there seems to be such a lack of a sense of judgment, of eternal judgment, for right and wrong these days. And that leads to a society where, you know, like a bunch of spoiled children. I was out in your city at the San Francisco at the Folsom Street Fair walking around and seeing, thousands of nude men walking fully nude down the street. And what struck me was that even the heterosexuals thought, hey, this is just part of tolerance. It's bizarre.
That's because the heterosexuals in San Francisco have been brainwashed for well over 25 years. I don't blame them. I blame Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi, who poses as a Catholic grandmother, had the nerve to say that she found nothing offensive about a leather fair where men whipped each other nakedly in the streets and performed acts I wouldn't even describe. How could anybody find that to be not offensive? And particularly Nancy Pelosi. How could she say that?
And where's McCain? Why isn't McCain raising the issues of the moral crisis? One reason I
tell me was, tell me why he's not taking the moral culture wars to the voters. Why is he not challenging Obama on the culture wars?
Well, he's compromised for one reason. He's got an aide, Steve Schmidt, his campaign guy, has a lesbian sister, and somehow he thinks that disqualifies him from speaking to the fact that Barack Obama wants to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. I think
somebody ought to ask. Well, Sarah Palin, to her credit, did say that she opposes homosexual marriage. And I saw that Biden immediately jumped in and said, so do we. He said that. He immediately said, me too. But the truth is, you know that the opposite is true for Biden and Obama. You know what their agenda is going to be right off the top.
And Barack Obama favors the full repeal, whereas Hillary Clinton only favored repealing part of it. So, and McCain has just not raised this as an issue.
Let me ask you, Peter. If I agree to send you a free copy of my book, Psychological Nudity, which story is it that you want to read the most?
I don't know. I have.
All right, then I can't send it to you. It's a real contest. You have to know which. You have to go to michaelsavage.com. See, it's my way of getting you to do it. It's very clever. And you have to pick out one of the 75 stories. So when you're called upon, you immediately have to say either, this or that story, whatever. You have to say my first autopsy, first dead body, Love by the Sewer Plant, An Info in Alley Pond Park, Fat Al's Tuna, My Silent Brother, Working on Cruise Lines. And as I say on my website, and I'm not kidding you, it's books are shipping, only a few thousand copies left. You want me to level with you? I'm approaching sales of about almost 10,000 copies now. I have another 5,000 to sell, and that'll be the end of the first edition, first printing. Now, the reason is, the minute the holidays come around, I'll probably wind up getting orders for 8,000 to 10,000, and I'm not going to have them. So I'm telling you now, if you're thinking of buying the book, do yourself a favor. Do it before Thanksgiving. This is the Savage Nation. Who stole my line, trickle up poverty without giving me credit? The golfer. How does he get away with it? I'll let you decide. Thanks for listening.
Savage.